Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and I'm continuing my discussion, my conversation with John Hope Franklin, centered around his new book, his autobiography, Mirror to America. And we talked about some of the personal aspects of your early connections with North Carolina. I want to, just so that we get to it, because it's so important, is that your work in history challenged, how am I going to say this? Well, let me say it this way. When I was growing up and took American history and North Carolina history in school, we studied about the Reconstruction period and learned that it was a time when a bunch of scallywags and unprepared, newly freed blacks took over our government, and it was a horrible time in which only through great force and willpower were a good Southern people able to take back charge of their government and send those scallywags home and put out of power the corrupt people who had taken power. And that was sort of the viewpoint of history.
That was
maybe I've exaggerated that, but that essentially was what I got both in high school and then although a more milder subject, that was sort of the basic framework in which
history. It was hard to exaggerate it, D.G., because I've read the books that you used, and you've described the kind of books that were taught when you were coming up. So that it's not an exaggeration. It's not a distortion at all.
Well, when we were talking earlier, you mentioned that at Fisk you had taken on as an undergraduate this research with respect to the free black in the pre-Civil War South. So that you were already as an undergraduate, maybe you weren't reading the same books and looking at the same theory of Reconstruction that I was at Fisk University, which a predominantly or all black university, at least as far as the students were concerned. When did this kind of pop up? When did you start resenting this older or the traditional theory of Reconstruction?
I learned in college a different interpretation of Reconstruction. Very interesting that, because my professor was white. And he was the white man who would later borrow the money and send me to Harvard. But he taught a different kind of Reconstruction history from what you learned. And then I early became involved.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, you had to have a textbook.
Mm-hmm.
You were, Ted Currier was teaching you history, mm-hmm. and United States history, Southern history. But was he using the textbooks?
No, he wasn't using the textbooks that I think you were using. The dean of Fisk University was Alruthius Taylor, who had written two very important books on Negroes in Reconstruction, one in Virginia and another in South Carolina. And he later would write a book on the Negro in Tennessee during Reconstruction. So that we had a different set of materials from what you had, and the interpretation therefore was quite different.
Well, it's not fair to not exclusively in the, but centered around a group of scholars who are primarily either African Americans or teaching in African American institutions. Are developed there already when you were a student a counter to the traditional interpretation mm-hmm. of Southern history or mm-hmm. of American history during the Reconstruction period.
Mm-hmm.
So you never had the burden that I had of a different view as your sort of first look at Reconstruction.
I didn't have the burden that you had. And there were many liberating forces in my experience, not the least of which was the publication in 1935 of W.E.B. Du Bois' book on Black Reconstruction, in which he took an entirely different view from what we had. And by the time I got to graduate school, I had read that book, and the kind of history that I learned from what history I did learn in graduate school in this period was a history which had that as its background, and which had Paul Buck, who was teaching Southern history at Harvard, as the interpreter of that period. And Paul Buck didn't wince any words about this period. So I came to it with a different orientation, and I was by that time independent enough to pursue the subject myself, so that I didn't have the burden that you had.
We talked in our earlier conversation about the unusual way that you had to approach things as a black scholar in North Carolina, dealing in the archives and all of that. But I'd like for you to think back. Here you were as a young scholar and teacher in North Carolina, having contact with some of our heroes of history, Dr. Hamilton and others who shared my view of Reconstruction. I mean, that was the predominant view, wasn't it, among Southern historians
yes.
during this time?
Yes.
And yet you had a different view. You were developing scholarly
yes.
Relationships with them. Were you all fighting about this, or did you just kind of quietly
put this aside?
We didn't
begin to debate the matter at this time. Their views still prevailed until about 1947 or 48, when they began to publish a new series on the history of the South, published by Louisiana State University Press. And E. Merton Coulter came out with his book in 1947.
All right, now, if you read your book, Mirror to Mirror, you'll find out who Merton Coulter is.
That's
but,
right.
But I bet you not many of the folks who, and I didn't have any idea who he was. So tell us who he was.
E. Merton Coulter was the distinguished professor of history at the University of Georgia. He trained a large number of graduate students as well as undergraduates, and his view coincided with the view that you described about Reconstruction. And he came out in 1947 with a new book called The South During Reconstruction. And it was so, from my point of view, so far off the mark that I reviewed it and asked for extra pages for my review in the Journal of Negro Education, and I took him to task, examining it in great detail, and declaring the book to be outrageous for the middle of the 20th century, when we knew better than to describe blacks as ignorant and backward. I'm thinking of the ones who were in the Congress and in the state legislatures and so forth. Those were not ignorant buffoons. They were serious people. And the struggle for education among blacks was very serious during that period. And blacks were trying to pay their taxes and trying to acquire property and trying to be respectful and respectable in every way possible. And yet this man described them as buffoons and as clowns and as irresponsible, ignorant people. And I very much resented it. And I wrote this long review essay called Wither Reconstruction Historiography, in which I simply nailed him for the errors and for the distortions which he created.
Well, that part of your book, that description interested me because, I mean, for several reasons. One, it was a real argument about history, which I think is the most instructive
yes.
time for when there's an argument about it and people, you know, not attack each other personally, but attack each other's positions and facts, and that way, you know, things get resolved. I love that. But it was quite clear from your there in many respects, your book is a dispassionate review of your life. But it wasn't at this moment. There wasn't any dispassion at all. You were really angry about this, weren't you? I mean, that you wrote.
Yes,
you,
I was. You, I was. It was anger. I guess I could say anger, but I was really. I was angry and distressed that in the middle of the 20th century, a highly regarded historian would hold on to these interpretations, and worse still, that people accepted
right.
his interpretation without question. And that's why, for example, sent 250 copies of my review of his book to historians all over the country, since, after all, the Journal of Negro Education was not widely read in the historical profession or in any other profession, as a matter of fact. So that I wanted to make certain that the historians knew what I was up to, and I sent 250 copies of this to 250 responsible historians. I mean, people of distinction and prominence and well-placed, well-positioned in the historical profession.
Well, I hate to tell you that, at least in terms of the impact that it had on my education between 10 and 15 years later, it had no impact, because I was still getting from distinguished historians and good books and Morrison Cominger, and mm-hmm. I was still getting a view of Reconstruction that was modified but closer to Coulter's than to yours.
That's right. That's right.
I'm curious now. You've watched this. What are the kids in school getting today in terms of in college and in high school in terms of?
Well, I find it very difficult to keep up, because the history books are written by committees now, largely for schools, and the history books are non-controversial, and they're still not getting what I would like for them to be getting. They're getting somewhat better interpretations in, say, UGOD, but they still have a way to go, and I regard that as unfortunate.
Well, I'm talking to Dr. John Hope Franklin about his recent biography, Mirror to America, and, you know, we'll be right back.
The High and Rubish Insurance Agency is an independent insurance agency serving our community for over 40 years. Why should you work with an independent agent? Because an independent agent works for you, not a big insurance company. Now is the time to be sure that you have the right insurance coverage for you and your family. So call High and Rubish for your free insurance review. High and Rubish will assess your insurance needs and make sure you have the coverage you need. Many of the insurance reviews High and Rubish completes result in no insurance change. Isn't that reassuring? Wouldn't you like to be sure you're covered? You have nothing to lose and everything to gain by calling High and Rubish today for your free insurance review. Call 913-1144, 913-1144, or stop by 6015 Farrington Road in Chapel Hill. High and Rubish Insurance, when you need to be sure.
Hi, Alan Stevenson from Team Wireless, inviting you to take a look at the new BlackBerry 7100i from Nextel. I love mine. Now, all my emails come straight to my BlackBerry, and it keeps up with all my appointments, to-do list. I can surf the internet, and it even has GPS capabilities. So no more getting lost or needing a map. It even tells me where the cheapest gas is. It's the future of wireless, because it's a phone, two-way radio, and mini computer all in one. I'm able to reply to important emails from anywhere at any time. With its smaller size, fewer keys, and bright display, it's so easy to use. And at only $199, they have never been more affordable. Team Wireless makes a donation to the American Cancer Society for every phone sold. And a lucky customer wins $500 each month for simply doing business with us. Call us at 489-2929. That's 489-2929. Or visit us at Oak Creek Village next to Chili's. For Nextel phones, service, and the hot new BlackBerry, remember the name Team Wireless.
www.teamwireless.com.
Wow, you're really blessed with a beautiful smile. I'm really jealous. Your teeth are so white.
Thanks. I guess I'm just lucky to have good genes.
Now, that's not entirely truthful, is it? Perhaps a little bit of a white lie,
Oh, fine, I admit it. I have this incredibly white smile thanks to my dentist. At Dr. Robinson's office, all new patients receive a complimentary whitening. So maybe I wasn't blessed with genetically white teeth, but thanks to Dr. Teresa Robinson, my teeth look wonderful.
Who's Talking with D.G. Martin can be heard once again Sunday mornings on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. Dr. John Hope Franklin has talked to us for a long time about his biography, and we're not even close to covering all of it. One of the interesting aspects is your early as a young scholar, your willingness to take on the establishment, and in this case, Dr. Coulter.
E. Merton Coulter, yes.
Merton Coulter, a distinguished historian who wrote wrote a new book about the traditional view of Reconstruction, and this young scholar, John Hope Franklin, took him on. What were the consequences to you, and the good and bad consequences of your attack on this book?
Let me say, first of all, that I did not do this with great relish. It did not make me happy that I would take on a man of great distinction like E. Merton Coulter. But I felt that it was my responsibility, that I had to do it. And it was with some considerable reluctance that I did. But I mailed these reprints of my article to the biggest historians I could think of. They responded in 90% of the responses, 90% of them were favorable to my position, and they thanked me for it. Some of them reprinted the piece and circulated to their students. Others ordered extra copies. Almost nothing but praise for me for having done that.
So the first results were that this was a reinforcement of your decision, a tough decision that you made to do it, was that you felt you affirmed by,
yes,
by their reaction.
Right, right. And I think that was the beginning, almost as much as anything else that I had done, the beginning of a recognition of me as a scholar. And as some person who could have some influence in the profession.
But I got the feeling that you didn't feel like you had completed the task in terms of helping revolutionize.
You're quite right.
What did you do? What
well, then do I later on, I wrote a book on myself on Reconstruction called Reconstruction After the Civil War, in which I took up all these matters piece by piece and bit by bit and established them as my own authoritative position on Reconstruction. And I think that's fairly close to what is recognized by historians, if not by public school teachers.
Right. This raises another question that you dealt with in your book, which is the intersection of passion and firm belief and things that are important to you in connection with the scholarly enterprise.
Yes.
The best writing comes when the blood is boiling, but maybe not necessarily the best scholarship. And how does a scholar deal with that conflict?
It's very important to deal with it. I've dealt with it in an article which I wrote and published some years later called The Dilemma of the American Negro Scholar, in which I said that when you look at our history, if you want to examine it critically and carefully, then you must reject considerable portions of it. And you must, in a sense, be not only a historian on the one hand, a scholar on the one hand, but an activist on the other. That is to press your case to the general public so that people understand where you are and where you're coming from and what your position is on these very important matters. And that's why I felt that I had to circulate my views on Reconstruction to a larger audience than read the Journal of Negro Education. That's why I felt that I had to write about the dilemma of the American Negro scholar. That he had to be certain that his position was sound in the field of scholarship. But then he would take that position and export it, so to speak, promote it outside the field of scholarship, so that it could have some impact on society in general.
Well, here's what I wondered about, and the history of the history of Reconstruction. History in United States history circles. I guess that you wouldn't have a wide readership, but it fascinates me. And in your work, you know, you're dealing with Coulter's idea that many of the African American political leaders in post Civil War Southern times were buffoons, as you put it. But I mean, and there were some who were buffoons. Surely, you know, there certainly are. I mean,
not necessarily
so
black.
What do you do when you're writing, or assembling and doing the research and writing a book where you feel like you just got to counter a prevailing idea, but you have to acknowledge that not everybody who was associated with Reconstruction was perfect. You know, that there was some
gray. You have to say that.
You have to just...
You concede that. You're not trying to make it a black and white situation, all positive and not any negatives. That's not life. That's not life anyway. So that all you need to do is to plead that you look at the picture carefully and you make some distinctions among people, as we must in 2005, as we must in any period. We must make distinctions and nail them where they deserve to be nailed, and praise them where they deserve to be praised, and evaluate them fairly. That's what you do.
When another point where your stature as a historian intersected with public policy, and it happened so many times as you describe in your book, your autobiography, Mirror to America, was during the civil rights marches. And there was some... I felt, as you described it, that while you were going, but that there was nevertheless, in the back of your mind, there was wondering, all right, am I a historian, or am I making history, or am I going to be some? Or am I going to be properly dispassionate enough so that I can write this history?
Yes.
And did.
You have to balance that. I have said on too many occasions that the historian who looks history straight in the face must also be an activist, because he will find that the historical process has been distorted, that the experiences have been unfair, and that he must try to rectify them in various ways. And in doing that, he becomes an activist. So that I went to Montgomery in 1965 because I wasn't satisfied with what had happened in Montgomery or in the South or in the country up to that point. So I had to lend not merely my pen, but myself to doing everything I could to rectify the evils of our society.
And you have no, I mean, at least your book reflects no, that you're proud you were there.
Yes,
and you're very proud that
yes,
you're there.
Yes, I'm proud.
And proud of your colleagues, and many of you, the prominent historians of the time, participated with you in that, in making history.
And we felt good about it.
You mentioned, and this hit me. I mean, this just tore my heart out when you talk in several points about the importance in your life of Ted Currier.
Yes,
who was your
mentor
and teacher at Fisk, I get tears in my eyes when you'd been accepted at Harvard but had no money to go. He went down to the bank and
borrowed the money and said, money will not keep you out of Harvard.
Anyway, then this all came back during the time of the 1960s, during the civil rights demonstration. And this happened on a number of predominantly black campuses. The liberated spirit took charge of the student body, and some said, "This is our university."
Yeah.
Tell us that story and how. I mean,
well,
it's still weighing heavily on your shoulders. I could tell as you wrote this book.
Ted Currier was still at Fisk in the late 1960s. See, I was out of Fisk for 20 years, more than 20 years.
So he was 60, I mean, he was moving towards retirement age.
Yes, he was moving very, very definitely toward retirement. He would retire shortly after that. He called me one day and said that, the radicals have taken over the campus. They have burned my car. And they said this is a black university and that Ted Currier had no business there. and that they would give him until sundown to get off the campus. And he called me and wanted to know what he should do. I said, well, and I was thinking of him. I loved him dearly, and I didn't want anything to happen to him. I said, well, maybe you should go and drop into a motel until this thing cools off. It will cool off, and then you can go back. He said, you know, I've spent 40 years here. My life is here. It's not somewhere else, not in a motel. He said, and it's more my university than it is theirs. I put more into it than they ever will. And he said, I'm not going anywhere. He said, they can go, but I'm not going anywhere. Well, then I felt sort of terrible that I had suggested that he run away.
Well, you were interested in his safety.
I was interested in his safety, and he, at that point, was interested in
the
survival of his ideas and his principles, and he wasn't thinking about going. And so I felt ashamed that I had suggested he leave, but he was very proud that he had said that. And he stayed there, and they didn't do anything to him. They backed off. But you see, tempers were flying so high then, and I wasn't certain that that would happen.
Yeah.
And so I had hoped that he would leave, but he didn't leave, and I was glad he stayed after he wasn't harmed.
This was a personal dilemma, and what, again, in reading your words, trying to read in between the words, in part, this movement of empowerment on the black campuses, this was in part unleashed by your advocacy for empowerment, and it was kind of empowerment gone awry, I guess, from your viewpoint.
Gone
but
wild.
Nevertheless, Ted Currier had liberated you in some respects as a scholar, had helped birth you, and then you'd gone on to help unleash this movement that had come back and bitten him in the in the back. I mean, it's very
powerful, very interesting. But I think that he would be the first to concede that these forces, even forces for good, can create some evil and unhappy situations. But they nevertheless would be important.
Well, the other way that you had to deal with this that interested me was in your job as chairman of the Department of History at Chicago.
Yes.
In similar times, not the same situation, but what happened up there that kind of...
Well, this was a big student movement in the 60s, 67, 68, 69. I was chairman of the Department of History at the University of Chicago at the time, and the students were just rip-roaring radicals who were going to change the university, take it over, and manage it in everything they possibly could, in every way they possibly could. And they took the administration building over. And President Edward Leavy said that was their mistake. He said they should have taken over a classroom building or a lab or somewhere, and they would have been effective. He said, you can run a university. You don't have to have an administration building to run a university. And he ran the university from his kitchen.
That impressed me because none of the other university presidents at Columbia or other places where this happened understood that.
Yeah,
they wanted to take it back.
Yeah.
Now, what was your role
I was chair of
part of the administration.
I was chair of the department, I guess you could say I was something of an advisor to the president.
You were in sympathy from, I mean, clearly in sympathy with the. Think with the basic aspirations of the students in terms of what was driving the war or racial injustice and things like that.
Well, the thing that was driving them most at Chicago was a lack of involvement in the governance of the university, and they wanted to help elect faculty and decide who should be on leave and. Decide who should get tenure and so forth. And the university wasn't about to let them do that.
And you were in total agreement with the university on this point.
I was in total agreement with the university on that point. I thought that the students should have some opportunity to let their views be known, but I didn't think the students had any role in the governance of the university, that is, in deciding who should stay and who should not stay, who should be passed and who should not pass, and who should get tenure and not, that sort of thing. I thought that students ought to be respected. Their views ought to be respected, ought to be taken into consideration, but that they should fall short of governance, for I thought that that was the responsibility of people who were employed to do that, and that students were not employed to do that.
We're talking to John Hope Franklin about his new autobiography, Mirror to America. We'll be right back.
And now, here's Deborah Miller from A Southern Season.
From our legendary Tar Heels to our incomparable quality of life, our hometown pride is evident at every turn. Named one of America's outstanding retailers at the International Fancy Food Show, we're bursting at the seams with award-winning gifts of good taste, glorious flavors, and gustatory delights. Our family of customers extends far and wide, but we wouldn't even think of calling anywhere else home.
A Southern Season, Chapel Hill's landmark gourmet emporium at University Mall.
We are on the scene at Performance Auto Mall to show you why you get the best pre-owned car and the cheapest price at Performance Auto Mall. Here's the man to tell us why.
Number 43, exhaust system check. Number 44, brake latch check. Number 45.
Sir, we're on the radio, and we need just a minute of your time to tell us why Performance pre-owned cars are the best cars at the best price.
Well, it won't be the best car unless you let me count to 142. Number 54, front end align. Number 55.
You're counting.
Headlights, number 57. Transmission, 58. Look, buddy, every pre-owned car at Performance gets certified only after a 142-point checklist, and then it's like a new car guarantee.
And if it fails?
It goes to auction. Out of here.
Okay, we made this minute count. Make your money count with the best car, the best price, and the best service. PerformanceAutoMall.com. Can't be beat.
Performance Auto Mall, proud sponsor of the Village Pride Awards.
East-West Partners presents Bob Woodruff, president of the Cedars of Chapel Hill.
The Cedars has created quite a stir across the country in the continuing care industry as a place with the feel of a residential neighborhood and service levels of a cruise ship. The food, the ambiance, the friendly people all make it a very special place. The grandchild of one of our members said, "The Cedars is like grandparents' heaven." I think she especially liked the indoor pool. The Cedars is unique in its approach of true home ownership, non-institutional amenities, spa, fitness, and pool area that is unequaled. If you've been looking around for a great community for yourself or your parents, come to the Cedars, and we bet it is exactly what you have been looking for. Call us at 259-7929. At the Cedars, life has been good to you. Now it gets even better.
The Cedars of Chapel Hill is an East-West Partners community.
You can hear D.G. Martin with a replay of Who's Talking from the whole week, Sunday mornings on News Talk 1360, WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. I'm talking with Dr. John Hope Franklin about his new autobiography, Mirror to America. Well, one other there were lots of poignant parts of your book, but one that I had to wrestle with hard to try to get in your shoes was the role that you played fairly recently that President Clinton asked you to play in terms of taking a national leadership role in examining the role of race and the impact of race on our country. And this was not totally a pleasant experience for you.
No, it wasn't. It was a very important experience for me. I did whatever I could to raise the level of consciousness with respect to problems of race in this country. The objectives were misunderstood by the general public, I think. We were not appointed to solve the race problem. We were appointed to try to stimulate some dialogue so that people could, with reason and with care, look at the problem and see what could be done, what ought to be done. But people thought that since we were appointed to solve the race problem, that one, it couldn't be solved, and two, it had already been solved. In any case, we couldn't do anything about it, and so we were opposed very bitterly by communications industry generally, especially the press, especially television, radio.
And what, where was this coming from? I mean, where do you think, I'll tell you what I couldn't believe. In a New York Times report, in which they did a very fine report on race, but they indicated that the President's Commission had not gotten there. You wrote a letter of explanation to them, and they didn't even print it.
No, I wrote I don't remember how many letters to the New York Times, they didn't print any of my letters. The New York Times had a big plan of its own to publicize the problem of race in this country, and they did in a series. On the first day of the series, they said that this is the way to do it, and they criticized us. And I wrote a letter about that, and they wouldn't publish that either. But they wrote a series of articles called "Living with Race in America," for which they got the Pulitzer Prize in journalism. And I don't begrudge them that. I don't think they deserved it for that. That's that. But that's just an example of the opposition. I don't know how many different reasons there were to oppose what we were trying to do. The opposition distorted, misrepresented, and told all kinds of untruths about what we were trying to do.
What on the positive side? What did you learn that you didn't know before, or not, and there probably nothing.
Oh, yes.
Brand new, but
I learned a great deal.
What were the things that you learned,
I learned, first of all, that a free press is the one you own yourself, and you can't get in on it if you don't own it. But I also learned that the forces in this country that believe that the problem of race is intractable are forces that have some very strong role and interest and investment in the existing situation, and they're not about to relinquish or to give up on that.
Which of us? And I'm worried that I might be a part of that group. Which of us have a stake in maintaining?
Well, whoever is that crowd of people that would be opposed to, say, a raise in the minimum wage. For that will liberate a large number of people who are now being exploited because of their poverty and the inability to rise in our economic and social scale. That's just an example, but there are people who maybe have no economic interest but have a social interest in having people beneath them. You know, it's amazing how some people thrive on being superior to other people, that crowd would be opposed to any change in the status of me or some other person like me.
Towards the end of the book, I guess at the very end of the book, you wrestle with the question of the young black male. I'm trying to mount a defense for the establishment people who would argue that they have the very best intentions, and they would say, tell me, Dr. Franklin, what we ought to do. What is the national policy or my individual policy? Because this is not something that we really want to continue. I might want to be better than people, but I don't want this is
Well, we've got to wrestle with our educational system and make it not only effective but open and welcoming to everyone. That's not true now. That's not true. All you have to do is read Jonathan Kozol's book, Shame of the Nation, or any other kind of findings like the group at Harvard, in the so-called civil rights group at Harvard that turns out reports on education regularly. We have to do something about our economic situation and our very strong, relentless opposition to equality of opportunity for all people. We've got to even reach out to the group that's been smitten and degraded all this time. We've got to reach out to them because they are persuaded that they're not a part of this society. And you can't just pass something in the legislature now and say, well, we did that. You've got to do more than that, because the people who are responsible for the alienation of large elements of our society have got to take the initiative in reaching out to those same people they've alienated so that they can be brought back into the mainstream of our social milieu, our society, so that they can have a part of it. So it's the responsibility is there for all of us who have opportunities and have privilege and influence and so forth. That's where the responsibility is, and that's where it must be exercised.
Well, you look, I don't think anybody would disagree, or maybe some people would, that you look at our society and you think about all the great things that America has provided the people who live here, and then you see these rough edges, as you talk about in the last chapters of your book. Now, we got to stop. We're talking to John Hope Franklin about his new autobiography, Mirror to America. We'll be right back.
Did you know that there's a new way to manage aging skin and wrinkles? This is Dr. Janelle Williams with Central Dermatology. Restylane, a product composed of hyaluronic acid, a substance naturally produced by the body, is a treatment administered to help visibly smooth facial tissue. Restylane is one way in which to preserve beauty and youth during the natural aging process. Restylane is a transparent gel that can be injected into the facial tissue, usually around the mouth and nose, to smooth wrinkles and folds. Once injected, Restylane works temporarily to add volume to facial tissue. The smoothing effect of the treatment will last approximately 6 months.
For medical or cosmetic questions about your skin, call Central Dermatology Center at 401-1994 or click on www.cdcskin.com. Central Dermatology is located on Highway 54 near the I-40 Exchange. Central Dermatology, protecting what protects you. WCHL 1360, time now for Biography for Radio with Jack Perkins, brought to you locally by the Cedars and East West Partners community.
He convinced some locals from his hometown to give him some money. Then he began to invest. His story next on Biography for Radio.
Why shop at Borders for holiday gifts? Let's compare.
I got you this toaster cozy that looks like a chicken, because I know you love chicken, and who doesn't like toast?
Or,
I got you this Italian cookbook because I know you loved Tuscany, and I know you love pasta.
At Borders, you'll find hundreds of thoughtful gifts for under $10. Borders, open up a season of surprises.
The investors handed over $25,000 each to the youngster who had just returned from New York. After studying economics, he seemed to think he knew about money. He threw in $100 of his own and set up an investment fund. Over the next 40 years, the smartest, or luckiest, of those investors sat tight. They became enormously rich. Perhaps it was predictable. At 6, the boy was selling bottles of Coke for a profit. At 11, he bought his first shares. As an adult, he read a book on investing and began buying unloved stocks. He liked insurance, fast food, chocolates, and vacuum cleaners. He read balance sheets rabidly. He looked at management and asked, Do they love the business, or do they love the money? As he made millions and then billions himself, it became clear what his love was. The ukulele player who drank Coke by the bucket stayed in the same old stucco house and drove the same old car. His only indulgence was buying a Gulfstream jet. Today, his annual meetings are legendary. He's been called the best investor of the century. He is the chairman of Berkshire Hathaway, also known as the Oracle of Omaha, Warren Buffett. For Biography, I'm Lawrence Scott.
Biography is a trademark of A&D.
Biography for Radio, brought to you on WCHL by the Cedars of Chapel Hill and East West Partners Community. The Cedars is the country's premier retirement community. Call 929-1995 to find out more on this very special community. Life has been good to you. Now it gets even better at the Cedars of Chapel Hill.
Who's Talking with D.G. Martin can be heard once again Sunday mornings on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. I'm talking with Dr. John Hope Franklin about his new autobiography, Mira to America. One of the things that we left out that was clearly maybe the most important part of your book that we haven't mentioned at all, and that was the relationship, your romance. Well, we did mention earlier your romance, but tell us about your wife and whom, I don't know. Well, tell us about your wife just in a minute or two.
I can't tell about her in a minute or two. She deserves more than that. I can merely
take it as long as you want to.
I can merely say that that without Aurelia being at my side those almost 60 years that we were married, without that, I would not have been what I became or what I am today. That she was not only gracious and kind and loving, she was thoughtful and judicious and unselfish and considerate and really, I can't think of any step that I took in the 58 and a half years that we were married that I took without her understanding that that was what I ought to do, without her counsel and judgment and support, and without her taking the initiative in many instances of pushing me ahead, such as when she told me here in Durham that I couldn't complete From Slavery to Freedom, writing it in my lap. And she said, you go to the Library of Congress. And I said, I can't go. I don't have any money. She said, well, I'm working. You can go as long as I'm working. And there were other times when she was most unselfish, as she did one summer when I was invited to be a professor at Cambridge University in England. And this is before we went to Cambridge as when I was Pitt professor, but I was going to go over to teach. She thought that we thought that we could take her and our little boy, who was very small at the time, 2 years old. We thought that we could take a family, and they wrote back from England and said that they were sorry, but that they wanted me to live with the other students so they could have better contact with me. Constantly, and they hadn't any arrangements for faculty. And they said, but if you insist, we can make some arrangements. And she said, well, that's not necessary. I'd be delighted to stay here. So I've been to England already, and we'll go again someday, and I'll stay here and take care of it, and you go on and teach in the seminar in American Studies, which I did. That was so typical of her, so her, you know.
Well, again, there's so many wonderful parts of your book and the weaving of the thread of that love story that is in almost every chapter is one of the very nice parts of the book. And I'm just sorry I can't keep you here all year long to talk about it. It's a wonderful book, and thanks for sharing all of that and sharing so much time with us today.
My pleasure indeed.
Thanks to all y'all for listening. We'll be back soon.
At home, at work, in the car. News Talk 1360 WCHL, Chapel Hill, Carrboroughs, News Talk and Tar Heels.